will just continue to post at the same time. Senate Bill 1036 and Senate Bill 366, both dealing in comprehensive fashion on school capital. And what I'll do is open a public hearing on both, and then folks that want to come and talk about both are more than welcome to, and hopefully we get done a little early, and we'll have a work group that will meet in the time that we have available after we close the hearing. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1036 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 366. Importantly, since 1036 is a new idea, Mazin and Paul and Steve, I think Mazin's kind of led up the team, has been crunching numbers to get a real sense of how much would Senate Bill 1036 generate for school capital. So I'll turn it over to Mazin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, 1036 is a concept in progress, if you will. The idea is to find a way to levy a tax on the construction, mainly construction as defined in different ways, and the definition has been in a way looking at three main venues: the new construction, the remodeling, and then within the both of the categories are the commercial and industrial. As the bill goes, in 1036, it puts the commercial and the remodeling above 100,000, or the below 100,000 is not within the scope. 100,000 above is would be the new taxation base. The bill leaves, as you were saying, Mr. Chair, the percent of tax to be levied clear, open at this point, in order to be able to come up with a more coherent estimate on what kind of money or kind of revenue we're looking at. The dash one amendment that you would see, 1036-1, took the bill and reworked the whole concept in a way that would change the timing and the point of taxation. The timing, as before, it was either or at the time, or either at the time of the permit, or by the AV, the assessed value by the county. Now it is more within the permit of construction. And that permit of construction to be at the time of issuing the permit or before the time. These are probably concepts that are still being developed at this point. And it, however, what seems to be emerging as an idea that solidifying is that school districts are the ones who would adopt the process by resolution and establish the method by which the tax to be collected and develop it in sort of a fund for the capital improvement that they have already established in their process and that they need in order to be funded by the new collection of the tax. The rough numbers that we were looking at, Mr. Chair, before that, if all taxing districts or all school taxing districts in the state adopt at 1%, we're talking on the neighborhood of about 50 million per 1%.
Please turn off your cell phones if possible.
So I don't have a cell phone.
Actually, nice strike, if possible, from that. Please turn off your cell phones. Go ahead, Mazin. Sorry for the interruption.
So, if all the school districts in the state levy this construction tax at the 1% level of the permits, the construction permits, we're approximately looking at about 50 million around the state altogether. But that's where the ability to set the percentage and fine tune whether you have commercial and industrial construction is included, whether you have an exemption below which is not taxed and above which is taxed, that is still to be worked out.
Great. And Paul or Steve, do you have anything to add? And I don't know if we're ready to hand out the worksheet that LRO, I'm happy to hand it out to the committee and to anyone else who's interested in terms of our first rough cut at what 1036 would generate. And if you or Steve have anything to add or committee. Okay, so we'll get copies of a worksheet that LRO has put together on Senate Bill 1036 in terms of rough estimates on revenue generation. The committee is now getting those.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, questions for our LRO staff, Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I would, if it's possible, I'd like to see a comparison between what this excise tax would raise at 1% versus what SDC capped at $4,000 would generate. I don't know if we can do that or not by school district or whatever, but it would be good to have that comparison, I think.
Uh-huh. I can tell you roughly that the first cut that you're seeing is that the Senate Bill 1036 looks like it would raise about half what Senate Bill 366 at their rough. And I think LRO is working on kind of looking at different districts and how this would affect different districts around the state.
Is that with the cap as written at 6,500 or with the recommended reduction to 4,000?
At 4,000.
At 4,000?
Yes.
This only raises half as much?
At 1%.
At 1%. Okay. That seems interesting because...
Very ballpark.
Yeah, 1% on a $400,000 house is $4,000. And this also picks up some other types of construction other than housing, right? It covers everything except hospitals and
commercial,
so on and so
yeah.
forth. Yeah. So it seems like it should raise more than half as much. I don't know.
Senator Monroe, remember the point of estimate of the value is the permit.
Mm-hmm.
The construction permit might or might not reflect the final selling price of a house. So if you start with and for example the last 2 years were a prime example on how things start with one value and then by the end of the time that you construct, you're in front of a whole total different new ball game, if you will. So if the point of taxation, and that's the part of the bill that is still evolving at this point, where is the point of taxation starts, and when is it collected, and do you do any true-up, and what's the process that needs to be established in order to make that reflective of where the policy decision comes at what point?
And an additional question, construction tax would apply only to the added value of the construction, would not include the value of the land? Okay. That helps me to understand why the number's lower.
Other questions for Steve, Paul, or Mazen? I know you guys have worked hard to try to get us at least some numbers that we can start a relatively rapid conversation on school capital, because we'd like to get something over to the House on this topic. Great. Senator Walker, you're becoming a mainstay of this committee. And home builders, would you like to join Senator Walker on 1036? And we'll do 1036 first and hope to move rapidly here this morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And I only want to take about a minute, and I promise, because I have appointments this morning. But I saw this bill pop up, and I love this bill. I absolutely love this bill. I told Mr. Chandler, though, when he came by to get my signature on it, that the only way I would sign on to it is if there would be some provision where some of this money would go to affordable housing. And I think that's important. I know that there are three other cities who levy a construction excise tax now. Bend is one of them, and Bend does set aside some of that money for affordable housing, and goodness knows they need it because of the price of housing. I've never supported SDCs for schools. People get mad at me about that, but I think it's patently unfair to just simply target residential construction. I think it's patently unfair that when my children grow up in my community and they go to buy a home of their own, they have to pay all this money when they've been paying their taxes like everyone else. I just think they're unfair taxes. That's why I like this. It spreads the burden, and I think it can be very effective. And I particularly want to emphasize the affordable housing piece because I know the co-chairs have targeted, and so has Senate Bill 38, which you've heard in this committee, to take the document recording fees for affordable housing. Well, I'm telling you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is no nexus between document recording fees and affordable housing. My belief is that a tax needs to have some nexus, and if you want to take those document recording fees, put them into building and refurbishing our court facilities that are about ready to fall down around us. So that's where I'd like that money to go. I would like this money for schools and affordable housing, and you can hear all about it from these great guys. And there's a great quote in the Bend Bulletin I'll leave with you, and I'm going to correct who actually where that quote came from. It's attributed to Mr. Chandler, but it belongs to Mr. Berry, and it says, "Houses are where jobs go to spend the night." I love that quote.
We're familiar with it.
And wonderful quote. But I do love this bill, and I hope that we can work it a little bit more and finally solve this problem of having money to construct our schools. Thank you.
Any questions for Senator Walker? Thank you. Ms. Berry, Ms. Chandler.
Good morning, committee. Mr. Chairman, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I'm looking forward to the data runs that the revenue office is doing. I've been running numbers myself with the obvious caveat that I took econ for athletes in college, and so I'm probably not the person you want running numbers. And trying to get to the question that Senator Monroe is posing, with regard to the construction excise tax, it's simply a function, as Mazen indicated, you're using the permit value. So it's going to be, to raise X, it's going to be a function of percentage. So if 1 point raises half X, 2 points raises two, raise X, and so forth. According to the calculations I did, just the Tri-County area, and I've not shared these with LRO yet, I will after this hearing, because I just was playing around with them this morning again. It looks like about a point and a half gets you rough equivalence with the impact fee at full throttle. On that point, though, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I think it's important to point out the assumption that all residential units would pay $4,000 is probably off, because I think multifamily would almost certainly come in at a lower number. And with other forms of SDCs or impact fees, that happens. Parks in particular. I looked at Clark County, Washington, how they calculate theirs, because that's the closest analog to a school fee since we don't have them in Oregon, and it was coming in at almost 50-50. So single families paying one number, multifamily paying a lower number. So when I ran my calculations, I assumed 4,000 single, 2,000 multi, and again, assuming that everybody was going to do them, which may or may not happen as well. On the construction excise tax side, again, it goes to the permit value. Now, one thing that's interesting, though, and I'll defer to LRO on all of this, obviously, but particularly on this point, in Washington County is where I pulled the numbers I have in my head. The maximum assessed valuation, exception value, is I think it's the right term, Ma, that I'm not sure, I may have used the term wrong, is $1.7 billion, new construction 2006. The maximum assessed, or what have they actually figured,
in
the property tax in Washington County,
okay.
Everything, commercial, industrial, residential, was $1.7 billion. The maximum assessed, or whatever the right term is, they actually figured the property taxes on, exception value, is $1.2 billion, and the permit value stated on the building permit applications that we've been talking about in concept of this bill is $1 billion. So there's a $700 million swing in those numbers. From our standpoint, if we could figure out a way to assess one of those other calculations, which also is being done at the county level anyway, that would be fine. That might reduce the rate, raise the same amount of money, and might be more congruent with what's actually being done. But all of that is something that, let's say, Revenue Office will be working with them as this bill moves forward to fine-tune it. The intent from our standpoint is to... And I won't go into all the song and dance or houses and spending nights and all of that, Mr. Chairman, unless you want me to, because I can do a three-part harmony. But
you lost one of your parts, so two-part harmony.
Yeah. Scott can do two at once. It's really a good trick. We're happy to do it. without going into all the issues on impact fees and why we've opposed them historically, one of the beauties of this system, I think, is two. One is that it more accurately reflects the impact of development across a broad spectrum. One of the things that always made us cranky about impact fees, and I'll be very brief about this, is the notion that housing had a responsibility all by itself for schools, when in fact housing is a response to economic activity the same way that schools are, or fire and police, or roads, or parks, or anything else. We're a form of infrastructure as well, and so the economic activity in a region is what is driving the growth, which is driving the housing, which is driving the school need. Having a tax that broadens that out, frankly, if we could, we'd suggest some changes in the property tax system, but I understand that's a little bit problematic. But having said that, this is the closest analog to changing Measure 5 and Measure 50, which broadens out the base against which the tax is levied. We like that very much. We think that's fair. We think it's equitable. The other thing we like about this kind of goes to what Senator Walker was talking about, and that is it's a system that you can calibrate, if you will. If we can take care of schools with a part of this and then add another piece and take care of some other part of infrastructure, again, using that same broad tax base and the need to spread it out, that's something we're very interested in as well, whether it be affordable housing or transportation or other needs. Heaven knows there's a lot of issues out there that could use some extra money, and we're open to those conversations. We would like to take care of schools first. I see Senator Monroe busting with grins over there.
Senator Monroe.
I'm sure glad the home builders have gotten a lot more progressive in the last 12 years.
12 weeks.
Events have overwhelmed many of us, Senator Monroe.
Look, we could talk about that for a while.
Yes, sir. There is a story.
Mr. Chandler, anything else?
I can't top Senator Monroe's inside reference there, so I'll stop and take questions, or Mr. Berry can go.
Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I guess just briefly to the numbers, and I know that many of us have spent some time trying to figure out what the numbers would be on a 1%, on a 1.5% construction excise tax. To that end, I called Tualatin just out of just randomly, because I thought I might be able to get a hold of a building official at that locality. I did, and they ended up transferring me to somebody else within the city, but I was trying to get a feel for a city that was already paying the excise tax that Metro currently has, and I found that they had paid it for two quarters. I grabbed the fourth quarter of 06, and in that quarter, at the 0.12, so just over 0.1%, they raised $23,776. They then took, again, that's for the last three months of 2006, at 0.012, so just over, again, 0.1%. The same year, for 06, 88 homes were built. So, and these are just rough numbers with me and a pencil, but that added up to about $352,000. If I took that same $20,000 or $23,000 and multiplied it out to get about as close as I could, it got a lot closer to $750,000 off of the 1% excise tax. Again, it's a snapshot. It's just that one quarter. I don't know what occurred in that one quarter or didn't occur in that one quarter, but that's what I had to work with. So I grabbed that one quarter and ran the numbers, and it actually seemed to be the opposite of half. It was double. I'm not suggesting this raises twice as much as $4,000 a house in every jurisdiction. I don't know that. I just grabbed one snapshot, but I was able to actually grab pertinent numbers. These are, again, the numbers that the Metro excise tax is currently collecting. And then they simply take that money, put it into a separate account, and every quarter send it off to Metro in the form of a check. They do take a small administrative fee as well, and that's, I think, discussion for us for later on. But I'm not sure that sheds more light or causes more confusion, but I think it'll be very important to spend a lot of time on getting down to exactly what the numbers are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just one more point. In previous conversations about, in previous sessions about school impact fees or SDCs, we haven't really gotten down to the nuts and bolts of how they'd function, so we haven't had to encounter some of the problems that we're talking about now. And one of the problems we didn't encounter was to what does it apply and how many of those things are there. And I'll put in a plug here. Some of you are, this committee may be dealing with it, others of committees may. We have a terrible data gap in this state with regard to construction activity. Both Metro and we are using a third-party vendor based out of Utah that's called Construction Monitor that's doing this as a business, collecting insight. We don't know how many houses are being built without calling every department of the state, every city and county in the state to find out, because nobody's tracking that. Portland State used to be in the business. They got their budget whacked several years ago. No one's doing it. And even I was talking with Mr. Bates from the city of Portland this morning. When I talked to the building department down there trying to run these numbers myself, like Mr. Barry talked to Tualatin, the gentleman I talked to, and based on what I saw on the Construction Monitor site, that Portland, and I'm not picking on them, this is what I was told, treats a mixed-use development, where you have retail or restaurants or whatnot, and then apartments or condos, as commercial. They don't break it out by residential units. Mm-hmm. So the numbers I had from Multnomah County, for example, showed 1,132 multifamily units in multifamily in 2006. I don't think that counts the Pearl District or South Waterfront. Because though because we don't know, I don't know, if Portland's counting those as residential units so they show up there, if they're counting them as a office building that happens to have people living in it. So there's some real gaps in the data, and I know one thing I've talked with Mr. Warner's office about is a lot of what we're working off of in terms of how many housing starts there are is derivative of Census Bureau data. Census Bureau tracks it by building code type, so it doesn't count. If there's a number out there that says how many houses are started in Oregon, it doesn't count manufactured housing because that's built to a different building code than single-family residential. It probably doesn't count high-rise apartments because that's built to get another building code. So there's a real issue here, both with regard to the number of units and the valuation of those units, that it's not chaff in the air. It simply exists, and it exists because, frankly, we haven't done a good job of making sure someone is tracking it. And that has no, and Mr. Warner's shop is not the problem here at all, or the state economists. It's the fact that there isn't any entity charged with doing this. So that part, I want to make that long explanation, Mr. Chairman, because this is frustrating for all of us, and it sounds like it's a confusion and delay, and I'm very sensitive to that. We're not. It's simply we don't know. 4,000 or 2,000 or whatever the number turns out to be on an impact fee times X is what we ought to be solving for, but we don't know what X is. Same thing on the valuation side. We're working, and I think Mr. Warner's office is doing an excellent job of trying to dig through those numbers, but it's a lot of work to call every jurisdiction in the state, even if you decide to skip fossil, which we probably could.
So shouldn't the Metro numbers give us at least some sense because they're actually doing it, and so that gives you some representation of what it is?
Well, yes, but I'll defer to Mr. Tucker on that, Mr. Chairman. We've talked with Metro, and I think they get a tad nervous about using their numbers for any purpose other than the purpose they're using them for. The person I talked to down there said that they've only been doing this for two quarters, so they think it's working fine, but there's been no audits. It's self-reported out of the jurisdictions. No one is checking to see if, in fact, that many houses were built in. They will. I think that's Metro's intention, is to keep an eye on things. Haven't yet. And like I say, Dennis Yee, who's the economist at Metro, I know he's been working with Mazin and his colleagues, uses the same third-party data source that I was using to put these numbers together. So, again, it's government going out to a private vendor coming back into government. So it may be perfectly accurate. It just strikes me as somewhat aesthetically displeasing, if nothing else.
Finally, Scott Berry again with the Oregon Home Builders. And I just wanted to add, in talking again to Tualatin, they didn't seem to have any problems or any issues with collecting. It was just, here's how we're doing it. There's a number of different categories under residential and commercial. It seems to be flowing in just fine. They seem to be writing the checks. Once it left the city of Tualatin and went to Metro, I'm not sure what's happened there yet, and that was a conversation John had, but at the city of Tualatin, at the city level where they're collecting it, they were not having any issues collecting them.
Right. Questions for the home builders?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
I've studied taxation all my life, really, and taught economics some, and I remember we've tried to determine what's a good tax and what's a bad tax. And, you know, one of the things that you look for is you want a tax that's broad-based so that the rate is relatively low. You want it to be relatively simple, inexpensive to collect. You don't want a huge overhead for collecting costs. You want it to be very difficult to evade, so people can't get away without paying their tax. And you preferably want some kind of a nexus, some kind of a connection that people will see, so people view it as a fair tax, as related to its purpose. And I think the proposal you put forward fits all of those categories, and I commend you for it, despite our past difficulties. I really do commend you and hope that and believe that we'll be able to come forth with a reasonable number that makes sense and that will help those folks that I care about, which is the school districts and the school boards, finding some money to help meet the need for all of those new children that keep popping out.
Well put. For the record, that's generally how it works. great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Small administrative fee has now been first time on Senate Bill 1036, so that's noteworthy that that has now for the first time come up, a small administrative fee.
Or SAF, as we call them in the tax business.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Okay, so let's we'll do three different panels with that we get to everyone. First, schools. So Dana, do you want to testify?
Yeah.
Dana Hepper, and then OSBA COSA and Trish. Do you also want to? Only if you want to say something on 366 or 1036.
I'll just go ahead and start.
Please.
My name is Dana Hepper, statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children and a former third grade teacher. And I just want to quickly, and I'm sure everyone here will do this, reorient us in the problem that we're trying to solve. And every single person on this panel sees it firsthand, whether it be Senator Burdick, who many of the buildings in her district need to be closed because they can't be repaired, to Senator Starr, Senator Deckert, Senator George, and Senator Monroe, where overcrowding seems to be the primary problem, although there are structural problems in those communities, too, for the older buildings. I taught in a school in the North Clackamas School District that was built for 476 kids back in the 50s, and then a series of apartment complexes went in, and we were added a number of portable classrooms to increase our capacity to 546 kids. Well, unfortunately, we had 600 students at our building, and that was after we'd sent two classes of fourth and fifth graders over to the neighboring school to learn in their portables. So you can imagine that shock to kids who had to change schools midway through their elementary school career. This, of course, has learning impacts on kids. There's been numerous studies that link the school facilities, the school environment, and a child's ability to learn. And this impacts our academic achievement and our kids' ability to succeed in life. And so it's just an incredibly important issue, and I'm really glad that we're talking about it here today. First, on Senate Bill 366, CAP school impact fee, this is something Stand for Children members have been working on for a long time now. And I just want to state really quickly, this is a tool that we know works. It's working in exactly the same way that we're proposing it in 11 other states across the country. So it will be very easy for us, if this is the road that we go down, to lift this tool and use it well in this state as well. It's a proven, effective tool. And I just learned that Maryland actually has an impact fee and a construction excise tax for schools. So communities have flexibility about how they choose to invest in their school facilities.
We can move both.
There you go. I think that's a great idea, Senator. Also, as the members of this committee know and saw in Beaverton, Stand for Children has already worked to significantly moderate this bill. We've pulled in all the folks who want an uncapped fee. You may hear that folks still want an uncapped fee, but everyone has agreed that this is an okay tool, and we've actually lowered the cap from the original $6,500 to a $4,000 cap, and we did that to provide more predictability to developers, to minimize the difference in the fee between communities, and we also chose $4,000 because it's half of the joint park schools fee suggested in other legislation, which seems only fair, but the joint fees don't have the votes to pass this body, so we thought going for half of that fee for schools, which is what would be allowed under that joint fee, would be a very reasonable, moderate proposal. We also moved the fee collection time up from the time of platting, which is very early in the development process, to the time of permitting, which is much later in the development process, meaning home builders have to carry the debt for a much shorter period of time. We've worked honestly and well with the home builders throughout this process. Of course, they're not going to be supporting Senate Bill 366. We haven't found kind of a compromise on that bill, but we certainly, and I think they would tell you, find a bill that's much more moderate than the original proposal. Regarding Senate Bill 1036, the construction excise tax fee for schools, I want to be clear that Stand for Children has not taken a position on this bill yet. We're a grassroots organization. That means our members make the decisions, not our lobbyists. Sometimes this is great, sometimes it's challenging, but we have an emergency meeting scheduled for Monday, May 9th, so we'll have a formal position on 1036 at that time. Two of the things that Stand for Children members are going to want to know, one has already been discussed. We want to make sure that Senate Bill 1036 raises at least as much money as a cap school impact fee that we propose, because the facility fees are great, and we already moderated the cap school impact fee proposal significantly and decreased the potential amount of money. So that's going to be really important to members. The other thing that we want to look at, and I believe that Legislative Revenue is working on finding these answers, thank you guys very much, is that we want the construction excise tax to raise the right amount of money in the right communities. So we want to look at different communities around the state and compare what they would raise under an impact fee and under an excise tax. One of the things that we're concerned about is a community like Sherwood, for example, might be developing a lot of homes but not developing industry. And do they really lose out under a construction excise tax, or do they still have the resources needed to build schools in their community? And so we just want to have an honest comparison for our own information and for our members before they make a decision. I also want to make sure the Oregon Home Builders Association talked about a lot about the numbers that they're looking at, and I want to make sure when we do these comparisons that we're comparing apples to apples, so not saying, oh, well, probably it would be implemented like this and maybe it would turn out looking like this, but that we look at the maximum amount both could potentially raise if every community implemented at the maximum rate, because I think that's a fair comparison, although we know at the end of the day that's not what's going to happen. So I think just wanted to mention also that we've also worked to moderate Senate Bill 1036, trying to find this very tricky center ground, but we've advocated for a grandfather clause so that existing communities with excise taxes don't get undermined by this bill. We've worked for...
And you've had that drafted.
Yes, and we've had that drafted. Are they in front of you today?
They're drafted.
Okay. We've agreed to a cap. We've worked with school boards and home builders to increase the flexibility about how the money could be used to make sure that any money raised is used in the most cost-effective way. So we continue, it's our goal to continue to be a voice of moderation and problem solving in this process, and we look forward to doing that with you quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Questions for Stand? School boards and COSA.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, and I'll testify on both bills at the same time. We support them both. We also support SDCs for schools. We've been at this battle now for quite a long time to help with school capital construction needs when we have growth in our communities. And we take a look at the dash ones, which I believe are Stan's dash one amendments to 1036. And there's parts in there that are really helpful to us. If you take a look at section five, if you have the dash ones in front of you, and we've had a work group going on about facilities planning and a variety of things with regard to planning that goes on around school districts. One of the things that you see in section five of the dash ones is it requires a school district to come up with a plan and hold a hearing and tell the community, if you're going to impose this excise tax through a resolution, you'd better have a plan on how you're going to spend this money, and you'd better tell folks in the community how you're going to spend this money and show them the needs that you have. That's something I think, Senator Monroe, you mentioned a nexus. I think that's real helpful in the process of creating a nexus and having that trust and accountability with the community. We would support 366. We'd support 1036. I worked with John Chandler on the excise tax. I have to tell you, we're a little bit more leaning that way right now than the impact fee because it does have a broader base. It spreads it across a broader base. We need to see the numbers, and I know your staff is working on that. That's something that's very important to us. One last point, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Bennett from COSA. All these bills do one thing. They address growth. And one of the issues that I have to deal with is I represent 197 school districts across the state, and not all those school districts are experiencing growth. And one of the things that we're still working on in our work group on this issue is how do we get our hands around a school district who doesn't have growth but still has huge capital needs because of the deferred maintenance that's gone on. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to leave that out because, you know, Mr. Chairman, as we've fought through school funding over the last 15 years, for the most part, we have equalized funding across the state through our state school fund formula. There's some difference in teacher experience and there's some difference in transportation costs. But creating a process where only growth districts get funds and the non-growth districts don't for their facilities creates inequality in our facilities. And whether you're a kid in Paisley or you're a kid in Sherwood, your facility should be similar in nature so that you have a good learning environment. And we need to get our hands around that. And there are some ideas floating around, and I'd be happy to share that with the committee at a later date when we have a little bit more firmer ground on that.
Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. My colleagues have really done a great job of summarizing the bill and sort of generally our position. We support all of the bills as well. We also are very interested in 1036. I think for all the reasons outlined by Senator Monroe in terms of the tax policy associated with it, fairness, the measurement of growth, we're not missing any potential measurement of growth in terms of whether it is singly housing. We tend to believe it also includes industrial and commercial development as well, which just creates a broader base. We have been concerned over the years with SDCs, particularly because that's been the vehicle so far, creating the impression among citizens that I gave when I bought my house, and when the bond measure comes up, I don't have to give again. And we think this kind of tax is perhaps less likely to result in voters reaching that conclusion, that I gave $4,000 when I arrived, I bought my ticket, I don't have to vote for the bond measure. We've just been real concerned about the public perception of these various kinds of fees and taxes. I think Jim has given a good description. It's one that we have not come to grips with, is just the general complexity of capital improvement and capital needs out there among the school districts. We're hoping to spend a great deal of time during this next interim ourselves trying to get a handle on what the facility situation is out there beyond the new school need. There are just tremendous amount of maintenance that has been foregone during the past several years that needs to be calculated into any kind of equation that would result in a fair distribution of funds around capital needs around the state. We took a look. I just got a very quick look at the Dash 1 amendments, and they appear to take on generally the issues that I think we were all concerned about in our initial meetings with Mr. Chandler, who has been very generous with his time to go over this with large groups of us in the education community, trying to take us through what at least the home builder's point of view is on this issue. And he's been, as usual, very persuasive.
I'm sorry that he's been generous. Better you than
using
me.
The words generous. I couldn't think of another word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I proudly represent the 20,000 members of Oregon School Employees Association who are working in our Head Start agencies, K-12 school districts, ESDs, community colleges, park and recreation districts, and libraries. I'm here to offer some support and some concerns with the bills. First of all, I have testified previously before this committee to our strong support of Senate Bill 366. We believe this bill has had lots of time to mature, and we think that it is an appropriate mechanism for you to choose to help high-growth school districts deal with their facilities issues. However, we also agree with what you've heard from Mr. Bennett and Mr. Green, that this is just part of the problem. We have school districts that are literally falling down and making our kids sick because of their deferred maintenance and their structural issues, and it is way past time to deal with those issues too. So whatever you do for high growth districts, I hope you do remember our concern with the other districts that don't have the ability to tax new construction or to provide a fee on new homes and develop a capital fund. So with my support of 366, my testimony offers you perhaps one improvement on that bill, and that is that I believe it would be possible, since you're crafting this today, to put in some progressivity into the fee structure so that a home that is a $100,000 home for a starting family does not pay the same fee that the mansions in the three-acre subdivisions might. I think that might be an improvement to that bill. Beyond that, go ahead and move it. Senate Bill 1066 is a very creative idea that we wish we had had more time to discuss and work out the details of. There are many pieces to this idea that are attractive to us, but there are also issues within it that we are very concerned about. And we hope that if this is your choice, that you take the time to make sure that it works for everyone, that the bill can be implemented by districts, and that cities and counties also have the ability to work within it as well. And to that concern, that is our first concern, and that is that this bill preempts local governments and takes away a tool that they currently have in their toolbox, when we know that they struggle just as we do in how to provide critical services to their communities. We don't know whether or not local governments support taking away that tool. And until we understand that, we feel very uncomfortable about taking away from one set of important services to give to another set of important services. The other things that we have concerns about are structural issues in the various sections of the bill, and I've outlined those in my testimony. I do think they are very serious concerns, and I hope that you will insist that they be addressed. In terms of what you tax and how you tax under the construction excise tax, I'd like to highlight my suggestions. There have been three ways to do it proposed in the Senate bill and in the -1 amendments. However you do it, we hope that it has a truing up mechanism in it so that the school district can get the full cost or the full value considered in the fee. So if you take the suggestions in the bill as it's printed, the bill suggests that the fee be based on the cost of construction as sworn to by the builder after the construction has occurred, or the value of the building is assessed by the assessor and the tax is based on that assessment. The -1 amendment suggests that you use the permit value as stated by the builder prior to construction as the amount that you base the fee on. We suggest whichever one of these methods you think is the right way to go, that at the end of the day, there is an opportunity for the assessor or the building inspector or the school district or whomever it is that's appropriate to true up that value or that cost, so that no one is tempted to lowball an estimate or to lowball a certification of cost. It's important that there be verification of cost and the fee be based on actual cost. We also understand that the amendments, and I only had a moment to look at them this morning, include a cap on the amount of construction that can be taxed. We don't understand why. If the purpose of this bill is to expand the base for the tax, why would you cap the high-end development where you can generate the most money? If it's appropriate to tax an industrial development in this way, why, for example, why would you put a cap on it when the high-end development probably has a better ability to pay than the mom-and-pop grocery store? With that, I will leave you to your deliberations, offer ourselves as very interested parties in helping craft a workable bill, and again urge you to pass legislation this time, this session, dealing with our critical capital needs. If it is 1036, please let's fix it. If it's 366, let's go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. If you could make yourself available, if we do end early, which is the goal, and not Senator Monroe, we'll get to you. That is the... You have questions? Okay. So if representatives of these three groups are available afterwards with some of the other interested parties, I'd like to do a quick meeting.
Yes, sir.
Following this meeting, if we can get done early. Yes, Dana.
Chair Decker, members of the committee, just wanted to add really quickly, I definitely hear and share Chuck's concern about voters being less likely or unsure about passing their local bond because they feel like the problem's been solved or they've already paid. What we see in states that do this already, Washington State, for example, has an impact fee, and they also have a state capital construction fund that a number of revenue sources go into that then matches local district expenditures. And Vancouver doesn't have any problem at all passing bonds. They're passing bonds on a much more regular basis than, say, Portland or some of our North Clackamas, for example. And so what we actually find in anecdotal experience from members who've knocked on doors for bonds in the past is that voters are happy to hear that they're not paying the entire cost, but that the cost is shared among a number of different parties. So
this
is actually a help.
Senator George and then Senator Monroe.
Oh, Trish, do you have the formula? Have you figured out the mechanism to take those slower no-growth districts and be able to, because many of them do have structures in bad shape. Do you have a mechanism in mind how to do that? I mean, do we take a portion back to the state, distribute it to them? Do we take dollars that might be coming from lottery to, you know, to help a local district and shift the percentages greater to the low, slow growth?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we have, in fact, we do have answers to those questions, not in front of me at the moment, of course, but yes, sir, we have taken a position in support, OSEA has taken a position in support of capturing a portion of the increased revenue in the lottery as seed money into a capital account as a temporary, that's a temporary capture, not a permanent capture. We anticipate that the capital sub-account of the Education Stability Fund will have money in it beginning in the 2009-11 biennium, and we hope that you will pass legislation this time to allow us a mechanism to allocate that money as it comes in. There are other ideas like that. And one of the benefits that we see in Senate Bill 1036 is that even in communities that do not have a lot of subdivisions coming in, they often have some growth. So those districts would have some opportunity under this bill to tax that growth and provide some money. So that's another benefit of that bill that we see.
Yeah, Trish, I was encouraged by your comments about the impact fees and the need for progressivity that we don't see there, and your comment that why should a $150,000 starter house pay the same impact fee as a $3 million mansion, and I've had those same thoughts myself. 1036 actually takes care of that by making a percentage of the value rather than a flat fee per dwelling unit. So that is one of the advantages I see of 1036, if we can fix it properly, over the 366. Of course, the other is the political advantage of not having a very strong, powerful group opposing it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, we agree with the first part of your statement that Senate Bill 1036 does include that kind of progressivity based on a percentage of value, unless you put a cap on it. I don't know what the cap being proposed is, but once you put a cap on it, that only goes so far. The second part of your statement, however, I'm not sure is true. I think you may hear that there is some opposition to this bill that isn't apparent at this moment.
Great, thank you. So if we do, and Chuck,
yes,
and Jim, if you can draw who it gets the short straw, and that person would stay. if we do get done early. Okay, AGC. Have not been heard. Well, they have been heard on 366. I'm not sure on 1036 up until this point.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling, appearing here on behalf of Associated General Contractors. Jessica and I are going to do our attempt to imitate Mr. Chandler and Mr. Berry. I don't think we'll be quite as funny, but we'll try. You never know. Maybe what we say will be funny. As you noted, Mr. Chair, AGC has testified and wants to reiterate its support for Senate Bill 366, which we believe allows school districts to impose a school impact fee on single and multifamily residential development to generate revenue for school facility construction and improvement. I think it's worth noting, as we've listened to the testimony today, that no matter what we do, the principal remaining way to finance school construction is going to be school bonds. And it would be an error for us to lose sight of that frame. And I think it would also, this will help understand the rest of our testimony, when you think about who are large, significant payers of school bond measure dollars, who really don't have any direct need for the services. They tend to be large commercial and industrial property owners who pay, who have a lot of assessed value and pay those bonds. So hopefully with that context, you'll appreciate some of our comments as the construction part of the industry that serves those commercial and industrial owners. It's also worth noting we are multifamily housing builders, and of course we would be subject to the school impact fee, so we're not testifying that somebody else ought to pay the fee. We will pay a school impact fee when we build those multifamily housing units. But we believe that the school impact fee does have a nexus between residential construction and the demand for additional school facility capacity. That's a clear link. There also is a link between the value of housing and the availability of schools. That is routinely, I think, realized as realtors and potential home buyers talk about the price of houses. That same nexus, in our view, does not hold as true for commercial and industrial construction, especially when you try to look at some kind of a methodology. Having, in my prior life, worked on behalf of school districts and having worked on a school impact fee now for more than 10 years, developing a methodology that clearly relates the fee that's imposed on whatever it is to what you're trying to use the money for is much easier in a residential context where you can look at square footage, number of bedrooms, which have some relationship to generating a need for school facility capacity. That same kind of methodology relationship is very difficult when you're looking at a commercial and industrial property. It's even more difficult because industrial properties frequently are re-engineering their facilities. They aren't necessarily building new ones, but they're constantly re-engineering their facilities. And presumably, since those aren't tenant improvements, they would be subject to this fee. That is to say, the construction excise fee. An important issue that I think the Stand for Children witness mentioned is that a school impact fee generates revenue from residential construction in the community where school enrollment actually is expanding. A construction excise fee, especially when applied to commercial industrial facilities, could generate revenue for one community even though the school population growth is in another community. If you think about the relationship of Corvallis and Lebanon, and I think someone mentioned Sherwood today, where a lot of housing is going on, but the industrial commercial development is someplace else. So you have misalignments of where the revenue generated goes to where the need is for it to be spent. Also want to reiterate, having worked on property tax measures, I've never heard one dissident community person complain that commercial industrial development weren't paying their fair share for new schools, but I sure have heard them complain about new housing not paying their fair share. And I think one of the arguments for a school impact fee is that it will help in securing votes for a bond measure. Last 2 points, a school impact fee can be devised in a way, if you choose to make it clear that a home buyer pays the fee, not a home builder, if that's an issue, by putting the fee at the point of title transfer, which is not a murky point. It's a very clear point. And there are fiduciary agents, title officers who handle title transfers. You can do it. The school impact fee that passed in the Senate more than a decade ago actually applied the school impact fee that was proposed in that bill at the point of title transfer, or in the case of some units that are owner-occupied, by first occupancy. But in either case, those are both, generally speaking, points that occur at a title transfer. Finally, we think a school impact fee achieves exactly what it says. It assesses residential development for increasing the demand for school facility capacity. A construction excise fee already has shown itself to be an advantageous tool for infrastructure needs that sometimes exceed the ability of ratepayers or a particular development or even a community to pay for. And we at AGC, because we also are in the infrastructure business, don't necessarily support preempting the use of that tool in selective ways for communities around the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And I just, Gary has put most of our points on the table. I would just like to say, for the record, AGC has debated 1036, and at the moment we do not have a position. We cannot support it at this time because we don't have yet enough numbers, and I know that LRO is working just extremely hard on trying to get those numbers, and once we have something more concrete, we will go back and evaluate it. But I think for all the reasons that have been stated by my colleague here, we have the excise tax is a harder hurdle, even if we have some solid numbers, for all of those reasons. And the school impact fee we're very supportive of. We have skin in the game as well, but we think that there's a clear nexus, and that's critical from our perspective. So with that, we're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for the General Contractors of Oregon. We're not as funny as the home builders. So.
You are funny. Okay, cities and counties, Gil, Andy, Metro, do you want to? Your name was invoked earlier, Randy, by name. Dan, are you fine with Andy, or do you need to? Do you want to testify also? Okay, come on up.
County clerk and county assessor too, about some nuts and bolts issues. If you
okay, we might want to hold off on that just to see what the work group maybe have one of them work with us with our LRO folks.
Good morning, Andy Shaw at the League of Oregon Cities. Cities are very interested in finding a solution to the capital construction problem. Schools are critical parts of all of our communities. However, this bill would preempt our existing authority to raise excise taxes, and we oppose that portion of 1036. As you know, Measures 5 and 50 are squeezing local governments, and the excise tax is of growing interest to cities who are looking for ways to raise revenues to fund the services that we provide. Four cities and Metro currently utilize the excise tax, and as Senator Monroe indicated about fairly assessing a tax, all of those communities engaged in broad discussion with their community, with local developers, in the development of those excise taxes. Cornelius, in particular, worked very closely with the Metro Home Builders Association, who support, as I understand, supported their enactment of their ordinance. We also share the concerns of AGC regarding nexus of the tax and misalignment. The majority of the cities that charge this tax use most of it for local infrastructure, to some degree for public safety. There's a clear nexus between developments of all sorts and those services, those infrastructures. We object to the notion of taking a local authority and handing it to another local government and then preempting our ability to use that, even if the local other local government chose not to assess the excise tax. A city would now be preempted from using that locally. So we urge you to choose another way of funding school infrastructure than a method that takes authority away from us. You could also pass 1036 without the local government preemption and give this tool to school districts and leave cities with the existing authority they enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Deckard, members of the committee, Dan Bates, Director for Government Relations with the City of Portland, share many of Andy's concerns. I want to reiterate the City of Portland's concern about school funding for capital construction. We have six districts that lie partially or wholly within the city, and they run the gamut in terms of the types of capital needs, from those who have been unable to pass bond measures to those that have deferred maintenance, to those that need new schools. And we are concerned with the issues that were raised earlier in terms of equity. Right now the system asks those who can pay less to pay more to try and meet the same needs. And we are concerned as to whether or not 1036 would address some of those needs, and I know those may be true of 366 as well, but we have a wide range of needs. And we really view school infrastructure as part of a tool and part of a need in infrastructure that goes with housing, that goes with transportation. And one of the concerns that we have about preempting the construction excise tax is that can be used for all of those, and at a local level we can make those decisions about which communities and which portions do we need to invest that infrastructure. More often than not, it includes school facilities, but it may include transportation and it may include some other infrastructure. I'd also like to reiterate Senator Walker's point. We would love and think it's important to have some kind of affordable housing component because they're so linked with schools and growth areas, and whether that's an exemption or some kind of set aside for affordable housing, we would be in support of that effort, but really do oppose the idea of limiting the use of this in this manner.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Counties agree that schools should be appropriately funded. In fact, counties are an integral part of the educational support system of the state. We assess and collect over $1.5 billion a year in property taxes, which is more than twice what we collect for ourselves. Counties maintain roads that serve as all-weather bus routes. We provide children and family services, developmentally disabled services, public and mental health services, and when there's trouble, counties provide law enforcement and juvenile services. We also provide libraries and museums for study. To remain an essential part of this educational support system and to provide other local services, counties need fiscal tools, particularly with the fading away of the federal forest safety net. In other words, counties do not need any more preemptions of their local authority. Please remember that county revenue measures must be approved by county voters, so by definition, they will have local support. We have, as you know, we're in a difficult situation. We've got arguably 36 different challenges now, we have counties digging deeply into the toolbox, and we need to have all those tools available. So we ask that the preemption language in 1036 be removed.
Questions for the cities and counties? How about if you set a set period of time for the preemption? That it was, since it's not been a tool that's been used very widely up until this point, you grandfather those in, and then you have a set period of time that the preemption exists.
If I could answer that. I think, Chair Deckard, one of the reasons cities are beginning to look at this more and more is that the effects of Measure 5 and 50 are more fully being felt every year. So this is the importance of this tool is growing as opposed to viewing it as a tool that cities have chosen not to use. In speaking with the finance manager in Cornelius, he's getting calls every month from other cities inquiring about their ordinance, how they've established it. So I'm not sure that would help the cities who are struggling with the existing tools they have. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you. Randy, did you want to? Yes. Jason Williams, do you want to also testifying together?
We've been in the same room together before, Mr. Chair. I'll let Jason talk to you about that one. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. And I'm sorry, I slipped out of the room for a previously scheduled hearing with one of your colleagues, and so I missed Mr. Chandler taking my name in vain, as he put it. But if you have any questions for me about anything he said, I'll try to answer them. I'm not here mainly to answer technical questions about the operation of Metro's construction excise tax. However, I know the basics about it. But if you do want some of the mechanics explained to you, obviously we have some people that could do that for you. I just wanted to briefly echo some of the comments that you've already heard from everyone, from Gary Conkling and Tricia Smith to the last panel. Metro, along with our local government partners in the region, in the Portland region, has been undertaking a long-term effort to reevaluate the way we grow in the future. We're expecting 1 million people to come to the region in the next 25 years, as you've probably heard ad nauseum. The impacts of that growth and how we're going to accommodate it are fairly daunting to everyone in the region. We're working on this project called the New Look at Regional Choices that you've probably in some context heard me talk about, and it involves two main elements. One of them has to do with the mechanics of the urban growth boundary expansion process, which I won't talk about here. The other one has to do with the very challenging infrastructure needs that the region faces in order to accommodate the 1 million people that are coming, both in the existing urban area of the Portland region as well as in areas that may be added to the urban growth boundary in the future, or areas that have been recently added that I think you've probably already heard about as well, that for which there is just not adequate funding to provide the pipes and pavement, basically, to bring those areas online. And so we've been looking in the long term at some sort of a funding mechanism to address what really over the next couple of decades will be in the multiple billions of dollars of need for reconstruction of existing infrastructure as well as additional infrastructure that's needed. We actually had legislation drafted this session that did not introduce it because the conversations are not really ripe enough. The legislation that we did have drafted laid out a series of possible funding sources, including a construction excise tax for addressing some of those infrastructure needs. And so I'm just here just very briefly to say that while we appreciate being grandfathered in with our existing construction excise tax in the -1 amendments, as well appreciate the creativity of this approach to the problem that you're trying to address, we have concerns about the preemption going forward, and so I'll just leave it at that unless you have any questions.
Great. Questions for Metro. Mr. Williams.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I think what Randy was talking about, us being in the same room, was last Christmas I was at the Reveille play where Randy was dressed up as a dragon part, and I immediately looked to my friend and said, I always knew he was a monster. Now the proof of it. But, yes, but anyways, quickly, our eyes are on the Senate Bill 366. And we'd like to, one thing that comes to my mind is the constitutionality. I know when the voters passed property tax limitation, they did so because, and they put in there that anything, any charge or tax that adds to the burden of owning property, they wanted a limit on. And I haven't pursued whether it's constitutional, but I do feel like it goes against the purpose of people who wanted a limit on their property taxes. And that's very important because people are finding it harder and harder to live in their own home. And having Don McIntyre as a president, it's interesting because every now and then I get a call in, and someone calls in, and sometimes they preface their calls by saying, by the way, say thanks to Don, because without him, without property tax limitation, I wouldn't be able to live in my home today. So that's kind of the counterbalance of what we're doing. And one of my developer friends, when he adds up his numbers for how much the existing cost we add to a home, he comes up with $20,000 of just permits and fees and a cost that we're putting on a home. You take that number and then you add it to the fact that, a lot of Oregon's biggest cities are in the highest housing markets in the nation. Well, we have that because we have a lot of unique conditions here in Oregon with our environmental rules, which are not anywhere else in the country, which helps to raise up the price of our houses here in Oregon, which makes it even more difficult for people to live in their own home. And that's where I feel like there's we're going after the people, and when we make it hard to go after people to stay in their own home, well, then we want to have programs for affordable housing, which we're creating the affordable housing problem. I feel like when people come and move into a community and build a home, those are increasing property taxes, and they're adding value. What I feel is taking away from value for tax revenue and education is a program like Urban Renewal, which takes direct education money and takes it away and puts it in towards a different type of capital construction. That's where our eyes are would be, to reprioritize, which we feel is economic development a much lower priority and our education a much higher priority. So as we look at that, we just really want to extend the caution that right now people are finding it hard to live in their own homes, and adding on construction costs or property costs would only make it worse. Thank you.
Great. Questions for... Yes, please.
I just want to clarify. You were a little close to the mic. You did say dragon and not drag.
yes, dragon.
Dragon.
And that's going to be the end of that line of questioning right there. Senator Starr.
Question for Mr. Williams. So Taxpayer Association is opposed to both Senate Bill 366 and Senate Bill 1036, or you're supporting one and opposing the other. Your comments seem most directed at the SDC. Just to clarify, you're opposed to both bills, you're opposed just to the SDC, you're opposed in general to...
Chair, members of the committee, right now we're just taking mostly notes because the bill is changing before our eyes, but I mean, ideally we want all the preemption and no tax increase. But anyways, we're just seeing how this bill performs. But we wanted to be able to bring us back to the basis of, hey, how these taxes hurt the property taxpayers.
Mr. Chairman.
So just a preemption, and just make it a preemption bill. That's great. This is very helpful. Chair George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I vote that these two are at least as entertaining as Chandler.
I agree.
You should have seen the actual show, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony, I think. Okay, so, Mr. Kreitzer, you have just some technical suggestions for us. Please come up and give them, and then we'll adjourn this hearing. Governor's office, you just monitoring? Department of Education, just watching?
Great. Senator Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Richard Kreitzer. I'm the Marion County Assessor, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Assessors Association. And just a couple of the technical issues that came up in the association that I want to just pass along a little bit is to keep in mind that January 1 is the assessment date for property taxation. So some of the properties that we're talking about are not going to be finished, and it could take 2 or 3 years to get the completed values on the rolls. Some of the other issues involved in that line of thinking are some of the appeals. We could put a value on the roll, and it could be lowered dramatically, and so who knows where the charges need to lie on that issue. Also, I don't know, certified costs of construction. In some cases, the builder is unaware of the total cost of construction if other parties are involved in the building of a structure. So that's just something. And also, a possible change of ownership during construction might be a little bit of a problem as far as who's going to pay some of the fees. And just one other note on 1036, my last point being, if any of this is tied to permit values, those figures are not accurate. They're not useful or dependable for any purposes, at least in Marion County. A lot of times what the building inspector does is just look at a book, open it up and see how big a house is or something, and put a flat fee on it. It doesn't relate to any market value or any real value that we're talking about here. And as far as 366, I'm just going to make one point there. real quick on 5A, referring to that. Some counties just carry land and improvement values on the roll and may have a real difficulty extracting things such as on-site developments, landscape, service development charges, those type of things out of the total land value to come up with a figure. Or are these all supposed to be included in the land value? And also, there could be a big difference in land values on improved properties versus vacant land values, just for the fact that they've gone through and developed there already. Even if you take out a lot of those improvement values and everything, you a lot of times you're left with that blue sky gap in between. So just some of the things that we wanted to bring to your attention.
Thank you. Thank you for taking a look and helping. And if you could stay in contact with Mazin, and we'll initiate this to make sure, I know you're busy, in Paul's office, just so that we're aware of your practical on the ground. How do you implement if you're going to go in one of these directions? That's helpful.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, that's it. So if cities and counties, if you could agree to have one person kind of ring the no preemption bell, home builders and AGC, schools, Stan, and then Costa Nostra VA has nominated someone, and I think Trish, you were going to try to be in the LRO library, and Jim Green is following this hearing. So with that, we can at least reconvene a smaller work group in the LRO library after I bang the gavel. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 366. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 1036. We're adjourned till tomorrow at 8:45.